Fall calls for comfort. Mack Weldon's got essentials designed for cool days and timeless style. Their new Ace line combines comfort with sophisticated looks. Go to MackWeldon.com for 20% off your first order of $125 or more with code MACK25.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's programme, young massive stars and how they form planets. We'll be speaking to Irish researchers who are using a new type of telescope to peer in on the nursery of the gods. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. We get to all of those comments at the end of the pod. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Tara Shine of Change by Degrees and Dr. Ruth Freeman of Research Ireland. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Tara, has to do with the ozone layer.
Isn't this great? This is a good news story. The hole in the ozone layer, that thing that terrified me when I was a teenager, is now at the smallest it has been since 2019. It is progressively shrinking, and it is evidence that when we make smart decisions at a global scale and put in laws and implement them, it actually works and the planet can then heal itself.
Yeah. In the 80s, there were three themes that I remember speaking to a psychologist / psychiatrist, and he was telling me about this disorder where you often find that there are waves of anxiety and disorders, and people start having these sort of delusions, and they're often linked to what's kind of cool at the moment. And during the 80s, obviously, we had the scares of HIV, quicksand, and the ozone layer. And the ozone layer is the only one that we've really managed to solve. Quicksand's still a problem, but of course, HIV very much so, and actually worryingly increasingly so in Ireland. But this was something that we obsessed about in the 80s and early 90s, right? Because it was going to cause a major problem.
Yeah. It was, and it is. It's a very serious problem, because without the ozone layer, we have nothing to protect us from harmful UV radiation. So it was linked to spikes in skin cancer, cataracts. It was damaging crops. So it's a big problem. But then in the 1980s, when we figured out it was a problem in 1987, we created this thing called the Montreal Protocol. And it's really like the poster child for how effective it is when you get a whole pile of countries together at a global level, create a treaty, and then commit to phasing things out that are harmful. In this case, a whole lot of CFCs and HFCs. And we've successfully done that, and it is allowing the ozone layer to repair itself. And so this is a really good news story.
Yeah, I bet there's people listening to the program who've never heard of the ozone layer. Maybe
really?
I don't
just
know.
Because they were born younger, maybe.
It's like,
maybe.
You know, a lot of people actually, you know, not to continue on this, a lot of people are very poorly informed about HIV. And the reason I'm saying that is because it's on the rise in Ireland and a lot of countries. And the reason is, when we were kids, the idea that you wouldn't know, because it was absolutely everywhere. And the ozone layer was a major part of our kind of growing up, in a way. It was the thing that we were very anxious about. But that was in the days where international policy yielded results.
Yeah. But, you know, there's lessons and hope to be taken from that. I mean, the ozone, you know, the Montreal Protocol had a smaller group of gases and issues to deal with than, say, for example, the Climate Change Convention. But it is still nevertheless proof that this kind of multilateralism works when you have a set of problems caused by a clear set of pollutants. So nevertheless, it's a hopeful story to be inspired by.
And when we think about HIV, I mean, the prognosis has changed so much in developing countries, and maybe that's where people have got a bit complacent. But in many ways, it's still a good news story. And that was also a global effort. So actually, it's interesting when you think about all those things that were so terrifying. And you're right, Tara, it is a bit of hope, you know, because we do need that. The fact that we can solve these things that seemed insurmountable at the time.
Yeah. Quicksand is still a problem, though. Quicksand is don't get into quicksand. I think if you go sideways, just if you're ever stuck in quicksand, if you go sideways and try and get out that way. I think I remember seeing a YouTube video at like 4 o'clock in the morning. It's like, if you ever get stuck in quicksand, here's how you get out, and you go sideways.
With droughts, maybe there's less quicksand than there used to be as well. That could have been solved.
The problem resolves itself. Ruth, our second story is actually a proper science story, and not about quicksand. It's to do with immune function and mitochondrial mutations. What is this?
Yeah, so this is research that was published in Nature Communications from researchers in Trinity College Dublin and in Cambridge. And as you say, it's looking at mitochondria, which we would have all learned in Leaving Cert Biology, were the powerhouses of the cell that created energy in our cells. And mitochondria have their own little DNA inside them, as well as the cell in which they're residing has its own DNA. And that DNA is passed down from mother to daughter. And there are a range of conditions that can happen if there's mutations in that mitochondrial DNA. And about 1 in 5,000 people have one of those. And people with those conditions often get pretty severe infections and inflammations, but we haven't really understood why. Scientists haven't known why. But this research certainly gives us some insight into that. So the researchers looked at macrophages, which are these big sort of cells that act like Pac-Man in your body. They go around engulfing invaders and getting rid of them as part of your innate immune response. And they had a mouse model where there was a mutation in the mitochondria. And they looked at the macrophages in the bone marrow of these cells. And they found the mitochondria were distorted. They sort of looked stretched out and were disrupted. And then when they looked at challenging those mice with an immune response, they could see there was changes from a normal immune response. So in a healthy cell, normally the macrophage would release a range of signals to give a balanced immune response. But in these cells, they produce too much interferon, which is a signal that's used normally to fight viruses, and they produce too little of other markers to give a balanced response to bacteria. And it also seemed that some of the DNA was even leaking out of the mitochondria into the cytoplasm of the cell, and that was almost stimulating the system to be like it was being constantly infected or inflamed. And I think this is so interesting because it's really just a single mutation, and it's showing what a big impact it can have on one immune cell that's part of that very important baseline innate immunity. So this was done in mice, just to caveat that. But it's an interesting signal to see how this one change can have such a significant effect on disrupting immune function. And of course, it also disrupted the way the cell used energy because the mitochondria was disrupted. So really, really interesting work.
In terms of the sort of mutations of mitochondrial DNA, are a lot of those tolerated? I mean, people often think, you know, you get a mutation in DNA, it could end up with, you know, birth defects or something. But how robust, as a geneticist, how robust is our DNA to mutations like this that still allow us to function, but perhaps with a greater propensity for obesity or a greater propensity for anxiety or whatever?
I mean, I think there's a huge range. I mean, obviously, when we look at our DNA, there's all sorts of different kinds of DNA. You have some conditions like, you know, Huntington's disease, where you can have mutations in a single gene that produce a very severe outcome. And we're all carrying around mutation. That's the reality. And we're all different. And when does genetic variation become a mutation? I suppose we tend to call it a mutation when we can pick it up and we see it as an issue. But we all have that variation and these multifactorial effects like obesity or even height. You know, we don't fully understand the single gene changes that cause these. I mean, in this case, these mice develop relatively normally. It's only when they get that immune challenge and scientists go in and look very closely at what's going on, the different immune system molecules that have been kicked off, that we see it. So there's a whole range of different, outcomes with mutations.
Tara, another study with mice, and looking at men, or male mice in this case.
Mice and men.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mice and men. Yeah, this is a good news story if you're an elderly male mouse, with possibly good news also if you're a man who doesn't want to age, but less good news if you're a woman. So this is a study that was published in Aging US by Cameron Cato and Irina Conboy from the University of Berkeley. So they took two drugs that are pretty commonly available, oxytocin and ALK5 inhibitor. And they found that those two drugs in combination boosted the lifespan by over 70% in these trials for elderly male mice. So that is the equivalent of adding 25 months onto the life of the mouse, which could be equivalent to up to 75 years in the life of a human being. So this is a very significant extension in the lifespan with just a simple combination of two drugs. So they not only did they live longer, they had marked improvements in their agility, endurance, memory, and they had a lower risk of death, nearly three times less likely to die than in the controls. So this is good for physical health and for cognitive health. And the bad news is that while all of this is the good news for male mice, for female mice, there was a short-term improvement in outcomes, improvements in fertility for middle-aged mice, but no long-term effect. So it is of interest if you're one of those tech bros that seems to want to live forever. I don't know why they do. So I'd say they'll be all over this and investing in it. Less exciting if you're a woman.
Any idea why such a massive gap? Because we talk about longevity studies a lot on the program. It's often mice and often adding something like that, maybe a quarter of the lifespan. It's not usually given very late in the lifespan of a mouse. And this sounds extraordinary that at the end, at an elderly mouse could add 75 human years or the equivalent of 25 months to their life. That sounds absolutely incredible. Why such a big disparity?
So they think it's something to do with the combination and the fact that that rejuvenates tissues, restores youthful protein patterns, and reverses key aging pathways. It's because oxytocin's in there repairing the tissues, which obviously tissues, you know, decline naturally with age. And then the ALK5 inhibitor, it blocks something called TGF-beta pathways. And what they do, I don't know a lot about them, but allegedly what they do is they drive inflammation and cellular aging. So it's acting to prevent that from happening. And then something about the two in combination is having this very, very powerful effect.
On just dudes.
On just dudes, yeah. So if you are a female, there's literally nothing much to report here. And again, you know, I don't know whether this is the way they designed it or, but what they're saying is that it actually shows that there are such extensive biological differences between males and females that this is why personalized medicine is going to be so important, because we can't simply take a combination that's great for preventing aging in men and think that it will work with women. We will have to find something else in the female context to get the same results.
Okay, very interesting. Our final story, Ruth, has to do with singing.
Not living longer.
Yeah, the opposite.
Not living longer at all. Yeah, and singing. So this is research that was just published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health from researchers in Germany. And as you say, it's about singers and particularly about famous singers and what the impact of being a very famous singer has on your lifespan. And whether you're a man or a woman, it's not good news. So what they found was the average age of death for famous singers was 75, whereas the average age of death for singers who were less well known but similar was 79. So they lost over 4 years of life by just being famous.
So did they put this control for cocaine?
Well, they did. Well, I don't know exactly what they could, if they controlled for cocaine specifically, but what the researchers did, it was quite clever. They had 326 famous lead or solo artists, or 324, and then they had 324 singers in a control group. So the singers that they matched them with, all the singers were active between 1950 and 1990, and they were paired up, so they were the same age, same gender and ethnicity, from the same country, same music, roughly the same era of career. And then they tracked them. And what they found was that it was only after the famous people became very famous that they started to have this impact on lifespan. So they could trace it back to becoming famous. And in fact, while you think about it, it's surprising in one way, but there is actually a whole literature on the pressure of artists, particularly those who are famous. And the famous ones who were in a band, if they were very famous, they still did suffer some of that reduction in lifespan, but it was mitigated. It was a 25% less than if you were a solo artist. So
25%
again,
less if they were in a band of four?
If they were in a band, so if they were famous, but they were in a band, they still had that reduction in lifespan, but it wasn't as much as those who were solo artists. And there is a whole
psychology. So talking about stress then, ideally, I mean, let's hypothesize.
Well,
like, you know,
yeah,
why not?
Exactly. Talking about pressure, talking about, you know, maybe the higher pressure if you're very famous of touring, but also, you know, that isolation if it's just you out there in front of the stage. But it is the fame itself that seems to carry the measurable risk, because the people in the control group, as you say, may have been having the same kind of lifestyle roughly as before. So there's something about fame. And again, we don't really necessarily understand the psychological impacts of fame, partly because we think of it as a good thing. I mean, it's something people aspire to. Some people want to be famous. Mm. Maybe they wouldn't want to if they knew that it could have a negative impact on their health. But, you know, and maybe we're not very sympathetic to people who, you know, oh dear, poor me, I'm really famous. But actually, when you think about, you know, some people start quite young, you know, we do need to have supports in place that actually protect people, particularly in this day and age when you kind of can be subject to all sorts of terrible things online, and you know, the machine can be pretty grueling, I'd say.
Well, I myself am delighted I've had such a mediocre career. That's it for this week's news round. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland to Dr. Tara Shine from Change by Degree, thank you so much. Now, Ireland is joining an international push to uncover the hidden lives of young stars using ultraviolet eyes in orbit to watch them flare, flicker, and maybe even form planets. Joining us is Dr. Emma Whelan. She's the Department of Experimental Physics at Maynooth University to tell us some more. Emma, welcome to the programme. When we talk about planets and the universe and everything, I'm always told by guests that, you know, we have to just consider how tiny our existence is in the long calendar of things. So how can we possibly be able to witness things like the formations of planets? Presumably we're getting a snapshot of that, or do planets form very quickly?
So planets form very quickly. And actually what we've learned in the last 10 years is that they form very early on. So our sun is about 5 billion years old. And we now know of about 6,000 exoplanets outside our own solar system. So an exoplanet is one that's outside our own solar system, orbiting around a star different to our sun. But it's only really in the last 10 years that we've found exoplanets around young stars, stars that are still forming. So they're still undergoing the formation processes, but actually they've already started to form planets. And so this is how, you know, these stars are relatively close by, so they're relatively easy to observe, and we can get lots of data on them. And it is difficult to directly detect these planets at such an early stage. And we've only actually found three so far. So most of the evidence that we have of them is indirect. But it's really important that we know that planets are forming at the same time as stars.
So remind me how stars and planets come about again.
So a star forms from a cloud of gas and dust. So they form in these giant molecular clouds that are everywhere in our galaxy and in other galaxies. And for some reason, we have ideas, but we're not quite sure. Part of that cloud becomes gravitationally unstable. So it loses support against gravity and it material begins to infall.
Yeah, so let's just pause on that point for a second. So you just have playing the tape from what, 14 billion years ago or whatever, playing the tape forward, the stuff's kind of floating around there. And at some point, the activity of this motion, one bit gets closer to another bit, they sort of stick like magnets. And then there's a tipping point where this becomes a much bigger and much more almost like a snowball sort of effect. Is that the idea?
Like a snowball effect, yeah. But these molecular clouds have magnetic fields. And so the magnetic fields do have some kind of braking or control on this process. So we know that the material infalls onto the young star, we call it a protostar initially, along magnetic field lines. Wow. And what's really important is that because of the way that the material infalls, and because everything in the universe is moving and rotating, and so these clouds have what we call angular momentum. So because of this spin and infall, we get a disk forming around the star. And so the material infalls onto the star via this disk. And it's in this disk that the planets form. So this is why our planets are in this plane, you know, in our own solar system. So while this infall is still happening, and while these young stars still have relatively young disks, planets have already started to form.
So and every really star important. Starts out with a disk that eventually comes together and becomes planets.
So That's what we think. Hmm. Yeah. So there are every star will have a disk. Whether every star has planets, that's the big question. And so this is why there's, you know, this is one of the reasons we focus on this age, this first few million years. We call it the earliest stages of planet formation, so that we can answer this question.
Okay. Yeah. So you said planets are created pretty quickly. You mean millions of years?
Well, we know at 1 million years, we have evidence of stars that are 1 million years old that have planets. Maybe they might form, they could be already forming at a few tens of thousands of years. We don't have the data yet. We haven't constrained that yet. We have hints.
Because all we can observe directly is, the last 50 years, if we're really lucky, even that.
So these detections of planets at 1 million years came from the ALMA telescope. Which was started, you know, really sending back data in 2016. Now we have other telescopes and other instruments now that are better at directly seeing the planets. ALMA saw indirect evidence of them, but we've only directly seen three, so it's still low numbers.
That's a very small amount, given how enormous our universe is, how many billions and trillions of stars are out there, and presumably how many protoplanets there should be. But I suppose at any point in time, it is a blink of an eye in a geological or cosmological scale, right? And so these protoplanets that you found, have they reached a point where they are spherical, or because they start off not quite spherical, isn't that right?
Yeah, so they start off not quite spherical, and it's only when they get enough mass that gravity essentially makes them spherical. Well, the gravity pulling all the material.
And so, what sort of level of matter do you need for something to become spherical? Because you'd think it might be a lot. Because obviously, what you're looking for is a, you know, pull in 360 degrees, pull from the center to pull the matter into a shape that sort of essentially gets crushed into a ball. But our moon is pretty small, and that's round, right?
So we know that moons are spherical, and we have lots of spherical asteroids. We think about things like dwarf planets, so I guess on astronomical terms, you don't have to be very massive.
I've gone off on one there, because this is my mind, I'm trying to figure out how these things are, but let's talk a little bit about the work that you're doing at Maynooth University. What are you you using? Because you're using data from a satellite, not the ALMA. You're using ALMA telescope data as well, but you're also working with a satellite. Tell me about this satellite and how it works.
Yeah, so MOVE is a new satellite, a new space telescope, but it's also a new way of doing astronomy. And it's only a very small telescope. It's a very simple telescope. It's going to observe in the UV.
So when you say small, is that like on a cosmological scale, or is it actually quite small?
It's actually quite small.
How big?
So it weighs about 19 kilograms. It's a small satellite. It's a CubeSat. And it has a 13-centimeter telescope.
Oh, right.
So the mirror is only 13 centimeters. So what's different about MOVE is the wavelengths it's going to look at. It's going to look at ultraviolet radiation.
Why?
Ultraviolet wavelengths. So we don't have a lot of telescopes that operate at those wavelengths. It's what MOVE will do is that it can stare at stars for a long time. So we can look at stars over months, for hours on end with MOVE, and we can look at changes in their brightness, so changes in how bright they are. And that can indicate the presence of material orbiting around those stars. And so that's what's very niche about MOVE. And there's no other instrument like it currently.
Is this measuring light that travels through atmospheres, or is that a different thing?
So it's a different thing. It's the light coming directly from the stars themselves that hold the planets. So
what can you tell from that?
So we can tell if there's material orbiting around it. So young stars are very, very, what we say are very variable. We call it variability. So their light changes. They're very messy, chaotic, energetic things. You know, as they form, there's lots of material, as I've already said, falling onto them, but also being ejected back out again. Mm. And all of these processes contribute to make them variable. if we can study their variability, we can, on timescales of days, we can, you know, connect that to their formation. We can learn more about their formation, but we can also learn whether there's material that's forming planets or actual planets or orbiting around it. Because what happens is that that material periodically blocks the light from the star. And it means that, you know, you get these dips in what we call their light curves. So if we make a plot of their brightness over time, we call that a light curve.
Right. And by seeing these sort of shadows of the stuff that's traveling in front of the star, do you get to have an idea of how old these planets are, or is the age of the planet and the age of the star sort of always interlinked?
So we wouldn't be able to infer the age of the planet or the age of the material.
There aren't like sort of the equivalent of biomarkers that, you know, if it's particularly flat or ovoid or not quite round, you can't really tell, because suppose it's quite random how these shapes form in space.
It's quite random, and we're only beginning to understand this phenomenon. So we don't have very well developed models yet for this kind of variability.
For sure, yeah. You only have three planets. It's not a lot of not a lot of rocks in your box to work with. So, but as one question, the stars, the young stars themselves, are they typically smaller and get bigger, or bigger and get smaller?
Smaller and get bigger. So they accrete smaller material as they they grow. Yeah.
And so how does that work?
So it works. So the material is in falling from the cloud, and it does this along the magnetic field lines, and it does this via the disk. So we talked about them having this accretion disk. So it typically, you know, they will become about one solar mass. It takes about 30 million years for a star to become as massive as our sun.
Right. And so what are you hoping to learn from looking at these blips that you can see because the UV light dips? I mean, do you get granularity in that? Can you see shape, or is it just a dimming of the light? I mean, what sort of resolution do you have?
It's just a dimming of the light. Yeah.
Right.
So what we're going to do with MOVE is we're going to look at a particular kind of star, which is a star that's much more massive than our own sun. And these kind of stars, we don't know if they form in the same way as our sun did. We know a lot about how stars like our sun formed, but not about these more massive stars. And so this will give us indications about whether they formed in the same way as our sun did. And then we can follow up, you know, any discoveries we make with more sophisticated telescopes, like, say, the VLT or the James Webb Space Telescope, that can give us that kind of detail that you're talking about.
And how, just out of interest, how does that work? Do you have to, you know, obviously the James Webb Space Telescope is the cutting edge of what's out there at the moment. Do you have to sort of justify your time to the people who run that telescope by doing experiments on other telescopes like MOVE first? Is that how it works?
Yeah. So you have to write it, you know, you have to write a proposal. So there'll be a call for proposals once a year. And you write quite a detailed proposal justifying why you need the time. And that's one of the difficult things about how we do astronomy, you know, because your proposal has to get reviewed by a panel and you have to be successful. But from the time of writing to the time of getting your data can be a year or more. So this is one of the interesting things about MOVE. It's a subscription. So I basically pay for the data. So it bypasses all of that. Now, there is a science team which makes sure that what we're doing is cutting edge science. But it means that I get the data much more quickly and I have access to a lot more time. Like I would never get time on, you would never be able to get time on Webb or the VLT to observe something for months on end. It just,
you only get a snapshot really of time because it's in such demand. In those proposals, like, is it just the science and the science only, or like, you know, does it matter about, you know, how much you really want it?
Yeah, no, it's just the pure science.
Like, it's just the pure science, right? You don't get to talk, do you get to, like, I guess what I mean, is there any storytelling involved just to explain why you think this is really important?
No, so you do
or is
have,
it just, here's yeah, the data
you do have to just so you have like what we call the science justification. And so there is, you can put a bit of emotion in there and say, I really need this data and I think it's really important for X, Y, and Z. Yeah, it's like mostly it's 99% of pure science. They want to know what exactly you're going to do with the data, and you have to show that you have the skills and the tools in place to work on the data efficiently. And
And so would that be then, you know, if you get really good results from MOVE and something quite interesting, you know, where you think this would be great to zoom in on this, would that be quite, would that be an exciting day to find out you got time on the James Webb Space Telescope? Or is it quite common?
No, it's difficult. It's difficult to do. We always get news about the ESO telescopes around the 22nd, 23rd of December. So it's always the best Christmas present you can get if you get time on the VLT. So I'm quite involved with ESO. I'm the Irish representative on the ESO Users Committee. I don't know if you're aware, Ireland joined ESO in 2018, which was a really big thing for the Irish astronomical community. It's so I would be quite familiar with ESO and how it works. And it's difficult to get time, but we do very well in Ireland. We get a lot of time and we've done very well since we've joined ESO. So it's another example of, you know, how we often punch above our weight with things. So we've been quite successful with ESO time in the last few years.
Great. So just before we let you go, what is it you're hoping to see in the MOVE project? What would be like, this discovery has really made a difference in how we understand young stars and early planets?
Yeah, so I'm hoping to see that these really nice, interesting, complicated light curves with lots of variability, which shows that there's lots of activity and material orbiting around these massive young stars. And, you know, really, it's really interesting to think about if these stars have planets, what would life or conditions be like on those planets compared to our own solar system? Because these stars are way hotter, you know, they're far hotter than our own sun. And if we, you know, if we truly want to understand life in the universe, we need to look at stars that are very different from our own sun as well. So things across the whole stellar spectrum. So that's what I hope to find. I don't want nice flat light curves. I want really interesting ones.
Okay, very good. Yeah. Well, let's cross our fingers, hoping for light curves for you for Christmas. Dr. Emma Whelan from Maynooth University, thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you, Jonathan.
Right, time to look back at some of your comments from last week's episode. And we were talking about how we exploit AI. Taha Yasseri from Trinity College Dublin was telling us that the gender of the AI we speak to actually has an effect on how we relate to it. Noel says, I wonder, are we more naturally inclined to choose an AI of our own gender? Interesting piece. I don't know. I my AI, as I said in the program, is this lovely, deep American voice. I don't know. I find some of the Irish voices can be quite annoying, like my own. I don't know. And in my way, I sort of a persona in my head, and I don't know why I've picked this voice, but I kind of like chatting to it, as I said in the previous piece. Rosie says, when I moved home from Australia, I gave my AI an Australian accent because I missed it over there. I think I noticed the accent more than the gender. Yes, I think accent is huge. When Siri changed the voice to an Irish woman's voice, I was like, yes, thank you. It makes a huge difference, I think. Paul in Cork emails us about something completely unrelated. He says, hi, Jonathan, you might possibly look into covering some of the recent findings into iron overload. This is not anything to do with heavy metal. It's to do with the fact that 1 in 90 people carry a gene that forces the body to store too much iron. Hope you might consider this for a topic for a future show. Do you know, I know it's not vitamins, but it kind of feels like a similar sort of thing. So we might leave it for a bit, but it is an interesting subject because we haven't really talked about iron. And I have no idea what the effects of hemochromatosis are, or anemia, really. I need to be reminded of every, I probably learned this maybe 50 times in my life. I keep forgetting it. It's what makes me a good radio broadcaster, I think. I keep forgetting everything. So I ask it like it's the first time I've ever heard it. Might look into that, Paul. Thank you very much. That's it for this episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin and Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.
With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got all the essentials for comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style you can count on. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and effortless looks. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25.